We're going to dive right into the text. We are in Matthew chapter 28, verse 9. Suddenly, well, real quick, what has happened at the beginning of chapter 28? Help me out. First 8 verses, what has happened? Say it again. The resurrection, that's a simple way of saying it, and that's an exact way of saying it. What else? Around the resurrection, what occurred? What has occurred? Have we seen Jesus yet? No. What have we seen?
Signs.
What is it in particular? The angel. When the angel came, what occurred? Huh? An earthquake? Exactly right. What else? Who are the characters in this scene?
Two soldiers.
At least some soldiers. And what happens to them at the appearance of the earthquake and the angel? They cower and fall down as if dead. And we have some other characters. Who are they? Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. Absolutely. What happened to the third Mary? She's gone. Why did we suggest she possibly left? Because she was at the cross. Yeah, possibly shame or fear or confusion because she tried to get her sons to be at the right and the left hand of Jesus. And had she succeeded in that request, they would have been hanging on the cross next to him. So she's gone. So that's what we have. And then we have the angel give the first of 4 commissions that end the Gospel of Matthew. He looks at the women in verse 8 and he says, verse 7, he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you. Let me just say this about the resurrection. One of the coolest things I have ever done for my spiritual life, and I'd suggest you to do this at any time, is go to a monastery, and they're around, they're everywhere. But at every monastery has a cemetery where all of their monks are buried. Every monastery. And one of the coolest things, every time I go to one, and I try to go to one once a year, every time I go to one, I go right into the middle of their cemetery, and they usually will have a bench there. And I'll sit down and I'll just reflect on the resurrection. And it's so powerful. And the reason why it is so powerful is because you sit there and realize that one day all of these graves are going to break open. Because of what Jesus has done, because of what he has conquered, these voices that are silent right now will speak once again through a body. And it's a moment when you realize how insignificant you are and yet how victorious of a kingdom it is that you follow. This past week, I went to a funeral of David Conrad's mom. And I have never been to a funeral like that. Was there mourning? Yes. Was it a different kind of mourning? Very different. Because everybody was talking about, honestly, what I heard most, and it wasn't just like one of those things where the person was really bad, but you have to say nice things about them because they're dead now. You know, it wasn't like that. It was just person after person, and the same thing kept coming off their mouth. She just loved people like Jesus. Everyone was saying that, whether you're talking in just conversations, whether people were getting up in front of everyone. She just loved people like Jesus. I remember sitting there, and we were singing a song, and it had a line in there about the resurrection. And my thought was, well, I had a bunch of thoughts. One of my thoughts was, man, she right now has a lot of the answers to the questions I wish I had answered. Because she can see what I have to only have faith in. My second thought was, can't wait to meet her at the resurrection. And then my mind went immediately back to this past Sunday whenever my kids and I and my wife were coming home. And I was talking to my kids about, they were asking questions about when we die, what happens. We have a morbid family. No, I'm just kidding. And I just started talking to them about how heaven and earth will become one. That this place will be purified, but it will be where God and us dwell together. and we will have resurrected bodies. And my daughter, every night since then, my daughter, whenever we talk about what, because every night we pray and then we ask them, what are you thankful for? Every night since Sunday, my daughter says, you know, I'm thankful for my family, and I'm thankful we're going to have new bodies. Every night. She is so excited to have a brand new body, because she is convinced, along with my older son, that their new bodies might include webs like Spider-Man. They are really excited about the possibilities. Because I told them, I said, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, all the doors locked, all the disciples are in there, and bam, Jesus appears. So he can move through walls or something, even though he's in a resurrected body. All of that to say this, what has really overwhelmed me in the past week is the hope of the message of the resurrection. That this moment of the first fruits, when Jesus rises from the dead, is what allows us to agree with Him whenever He looks at us and says, do not be afraid. Because what can Satan do to us? What can he do? If we are faithful to Jesus, the best he can do is kill us. And that is what we want. Because that's how we gain victory. Because that sends me straight to the point of living with Jesus and knowing that I'm assured of having a resurrected body. What can he do? Anyone that says that Satan is not limited because of what Jesus did isn't paying attention to the resurrection. What do we have to fear? Nothing. Listen to the cloud of witnesses. Let them whisper to you. Because I think they're unifyingly saying, trust me, death is awesome because of what he did. Second Great Commission. Jesus, in verse 9, suddenly Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. Greetings is a fascinating word throughout the Gospel of Matthew. A fascinating word. Because it moves from a word of victory and jubilation into a word that is hijacked by evil, and Jesus reclaims it here at the resurrection. First time we see it in Matthew is Matthew chapter 2, verse 10. Whenever the Magi are looking for Jesus, they go to Herod, and all of a sudden the star reappears after they leave Herod. And it says, they were Cairo, they were overjoyed, they were rejoicing. Same word. Chapter 5, verse 12, the Beatitudes, it says at the end of it, rejoice and be glad. Why? Because when you are persecuted because of Jesus, you're in good company along with the prophets. Chapter 18, verse 13, it says that God is happier, Cairo, whenever he finds one of the sheep, one of the valuable sheep, one of the little ones that has gone astray. And then chapter 26, verse 49, there's a shift in the way the word is used and by whom it is used. For all of a sudden, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Judas walks up and he says, Cairo, Rabbi, greetings. Chapter 27, verse 29, when all the soldiers are beating Jesus and mocking him, they surround him and they say, Hail, King of the Jews! The word for hail is Cairo, same word. And Jesus comes and he says, what the agents of evil have hijacked and mocked me with, now at my resurrection will show that I have been victorious. Because he looks at him and he says, greetings. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Notice this. Whenever the soldiers at the tomb fall down as though dead, no one ever tells them, do not be afraid. When you're an insider, you don't have a reason to be afraid. When you're an outsider, you don't get words like that of comfort. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, there they will see me. Very significant. Why? What? He uses the word brothers. And who's he talking about? The disciples, the thugs that abandoned him at the cross. And yet he says, because of my grace, they're still my family. They're still my family. Second Great Commission, and the women run. They run. While the women were on their way, some of the guard, in a good way, running in a good way, by the way, sorry, that sounded funny. While the women were on their way, Some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. So now the guards are like, oh no, something has occurred. And what? Just, I wish I could have been a fly on the wall in that conversation. The guards run into the chief priests and they're like, yeah, man, you're not going to believe this. Big old white light, big angel falling down, shaking like dead, rock pulls back, guy's gone, don't know what to do. The chief priests are just like, interesting. You know, I mean, when the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, because they're like, we need to figure something out, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money. That seems to be their response to everything. You know? We talked about pretty much the two key contrasting characteristics of the kingdoms that are sitting next to each other. One of them is violence, and the other one is wealth. Whenever something happens that you don't know how to respond to, whatever kingdom you're committed to, that is how you will react, because that's the way in which your mind functions. And when you are committed to a political kingdom or a political program that is governed by violence and wealth, that is how you try to fix every solution. Bad thing happens. What do they do? Throw money at it. If that doesn't work, kill someone. That's all they know how to do. They gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, you are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. Very interesting parallel. Because the disciples also had a sleeping problem, didn't they? Yeah, they did. What's also interesting about this is that, remember why they had guards there in the first place? What was the reason? What was the reason they kept saying over and over that they wanted to have guards there? Why? Why did they want them there? To keep the deception from going. Now that the deception has occurred, what are they doing to try to cover it up? Deceiving through the guards. Interesting parallel. Yes.
Were the guards Romans?
Yes. See, and that's kind of what we see here with this political exchange. Because if these were just Jewish soldiers, they would not have had to go and report to Pilate at all. They wouldn't. There's no reason for it. Matter of fact, that, like we said before, the Jews wouldn't have had to have gone to Pilate to ask for guards. They could have put their own there. We know the Romans because of Pilate's involvement in this. Their failure in it, again, would they have been punished? Yeah, but again, it's never about innocence or guilty. What it's about is political posturing. If Pilate looks and sees that the Jews are okay with what's happened, he doesn't have to obey any of the laws as long as peace is kept. As long as peace is kept. And all the Jews are, if the Jews were upset at the guards would have been done. But the Jews realized in their own political posturing that their upsetness at the guards would validate a potential story that could cause the deception to further. Therefore, they want to cover it up. They want it to go away. They don't want a big deal to happen. They just want it to disappear. And that's their motivation. Therefore, Pilate's not going to make a big ruse about it because he just wants peace. So again, the answers are never as yes and no when you're dealing with political powers. There's always undercurrents that dictate which way the river has to flow. I won't give that illustration, but okay. Where was I at? Oh yeah, verse 14. If this report gets to the governor, see, they're not even really caring if it gets to him. They're not, it's okay, man. You don't have to go tell him, but, you know, whatever. We will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. Why? Because the soldiers know the real story. That's why. The soldiers are a hot commodity for these Jews. Because they know the real story. They want to act like it just never happened. And if the governor finds out it happens, trust me, we'll smooth it over. Everyone's good. Move on. So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. This is the third commission that ends the Gospel of Matthew. All four of these commissions will be obeyed. We see the results of the first three, and the fourth one we don't. The only reason why I know the fourth one is obeyed is because we're here today. But we'll get to that by and by. Point is, they obey a commission that drastically contrasts the commissions that we see from Jesus and the angel. In that, their commission is to perpetuate a lie, to keep the truth under wraps. And the exact opposite is what the commission that Jesus and his angel give. So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. Notice, no one says that the tomb wasn't empty. That is not the Jewish defense, is it? Historically, it is a nice thing 2,000 years to be able to pontificate about what happened in the annals of history whenever you only have to wrestle with words. So it's easy to say, oh, you know, they went to the wrong tomb, or, oh, you know, the tomb wasn't empty, it actually was full, or, oh, you know, there wasn't a tomb, he was buried in a mass grave and dogs dug it up, and etc. Very easy to say that 2,000 years from now. But why don't we see any of the Jewish documents making that argument? It's very nice to be able to rewrite history. We try to do it even within the last 100 years. We love to rewrite history. But the thing is this isn't a history we can rewrite. Everyone agrees the tomb was empty. The question is not if it was empty, it was did it become empty? How did it become empty? Did the disciples steal it, or did someone raise from the dead? That's the issue. So this whole the tomb wasn't empty stuff is just silly. I mean, at that point, like I said, I can make up whatever I want. Let's start talking about Star Trek or something, because we can bring in anything at that point. All right. Verse 16, then the 11 disciples went to Galilee. What do I notice there? What? Yeah. That would bring me both joy and sadness. Why sadness? Yeah. Because in chapter 27, verses what? 3 through 6, Judas killed himself. And that's why there's 11. Why would it bring me joy? Because last time I saw Peter, it didn't look so good. We never hear Peter's name after he denies Jesus. Never. The only evidence in Matthew's gospel that I have that Peter is reinstituted is the word 11 right here. Otherwise, I would have no idea if Peter made it back or not. Because whenever we left Peter, he looked worse than Judas. Remember? Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee. Why did they go to Galilee? Exactly. That is exactly where Jesus told them they would go. They say at the Lord's Supper, they're like, we will never disown you. And he goes, matter of fact, you all are going to abandon me. Every one of you. And he says, and yet after I raise from the dead, I'll meet you again in Galilee. And I find it very fitting that the Gospel of Matthew begins with the ministry of Jesus in Galilee. And it ends in Galilee. Matter of fact, we're going to see that several different times. Matthew's bookending his gospel. He's wrapping things up. So we're going to be moving back to Galilee, where Jesus told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, just like the women. But some doubted. Who is the doubter? You know, that's interesting. Because we get that answer from John, and not from Matthew. John wasn't written until how many years later? Potentially 20 to 30 years after Matthew. So until we got John, who would the answer have been? Yeah, you know what's interesting? Is the only other time this word is used in the Gospel of Matthew is in Matthew chapter 14. What happens there in what chapter, scholars? What? Jesus walks on the water. And he comes beside the boat, and what happens? He says, I'm not a ghost, don't freak out. And awesome Peter says, hey, if you're not a ghost, if you are the Lord, let me come out there and walk with you. And he's like, I'm down. So Peter hops out, starts to walk. Then what happens? Takes his eyes off Jesus, starts to sink, freaks out. Jesus says, you have little faith, why do you doubt? The only time this word is used in the Gospel of Matthew, it is associated with Peter. And frankly, he is the only disciple that enacts this particular aspect or this particular quality. Yeah? If I'm just reading the Gospel of Matthew, In this context, the one that is doubting, I would have to conclude it was Peter, not Thomas. Even though John tells us in John chapter 20 that Thomas does doubt, and he does get a little reputation for that, poor guy, doubting Thomas, how do you like that? I'm the guy with no faith, you know. Shane, no faith would. Awesome. In Gospel of Matthew, that Thomas just doesn't really appear outside of chapter 10 whenever he's listed in a list. Matter of fact, hardly any disciples appear except for the inner three and Judas. That's it. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." What are you hearing? What? Identity language? What else are you hearing? My kingdom, kingdom people. What are you hearing?
Changed.
What?
Changed.
Everything has changed. What in particular has changed? Who else is saying this particular phrase? All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me to rule the world. Who's saying this? Rome. And Jesus comes along and he says, no. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. If somebody would say that out loud, they'd be killed. But how do you kill a person that's resurrected from the first time you killed them? What do you do with a guy like that? Answer, you bow down and worship him. Because whenever you've used the best weapons that your kingdom can offer and it still hasn't won, surrender, surrender, surrender. Jesus comes and he says, no, I have all the authority. Not just on earth, in heaven too. Matter of fact, this even kind of reminds me of another passage in Matthew, doesn't it? What passage? I'll give you a hint. Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And Jesus says, in me, that's fulfilled. How? Through you. Verse 19, therefore, since I have all the authority, therefore, go and make disciples of all nations. What is he saying? Because I have all authority, you go conquer the world. I am the kingdom that's in charge now. And we are going to rule the world. How are we to go conquer? The same way Jesus conquered. By carrying a cross. By living our lives like the Sermon on the Mount. By obeying the commission of the Sermon on Mission in chapter 10. By trusting the value and the program of the kingdom in Matthew chapter 13. By obeying the values of the kingdoms and the way in which we live in Matthew 18. And by submitting to the faith that we have that comes from the Olivet Discourse in Matthew chapter 23 through 25. By looking at His Pentateuch and living it out every day. That's how we win. That's how we conquer. Why? Because He has risen from the dead and He has all the authority. Therefore, do not fear. Go and conquer the world. Because remember that the gates of Hades will not even overcome when the church wakes up and decides to start to fight. Go, make disciples of all nations. Baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. What is He saying? You make, you win, you conquer by bringing them into our community. Baptism, you've got to think in communal terms. This is the way that you symbolize that you are moving from one allegiance to another, from one community to another. He says you go. You make disciples by bringing them into your community. The goal is not dunking them. The goal is teaching them the ways of the community so that they know how to live both inside the walls and outside. That you teach them everything He has taught you in the Pentateuch of the Gospel of Matthew. This is not a commission just to get people wet. It is a commission to bring people into a whole new way of living that is characterized by the resurrection and that is dictated by the cross. The cross is not just for salvation, it is also an ethic. It is also an ethic. and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And that's why I keep going back to the five discourses. Matthew has the five major discourses because this is what Jesus is referring to here. He says, what have I commanded you? Look at the Sermon on the Mount. Look at the Sermon on Mission. Look at the parables of the kingdom. Look at the Sermon on Community. Look at the Olivet Discourse. This is what I have commanded you to do. This is what I want you to teach to the world. This is how we win. This is how we win. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age. This book ends the Gospel of Matthew because remember when Jesus was born and Isaiah chapter 7 was quoted and they use a name that he will be called. And what was that name? Emmanuel, which means what? God with us. At the very beginning of the book of Matthew, he says, God with us is here. And Jesus at the end of the Gospel of Matthew says, God with us will be with you always. Until when? What is the word for end there that he uses? Anybody want to guess? I hear the S's and that's positive. Soontelea. In the Gospel of Matthew, soontelea, contrasting telos, always means second coming. Always. So here with 5 minutes left is my message to you. The Gospel of Matthew is not calling you just to pray more. The Gospel of Matthew is not calling you to keep your devotions. The Gospel of Matthew is not calling you to fast or to do the whole list of Christian things that we say that you need to do. The Gospel of Matthew is calling you to a kingdom. A kingdom that is ruling the world, whether you admit it, acknowledge it, or not. It's calling you to a lifestyle. It's calling you to a cross. And the question is, which one of the final great commissions will you obey? He ends with emphasizing four great commissions for a purpose. Because at the very end, you have one great commission that is not told whether or not it will be fulfilled by the disciples. But the very fact that you're here tells me that they have fulfilled it. And the question is, should it be any different for you? He's given you a commission. I think it's pretty clear. So it's not a matter of what is the commission. It's a matter of will you obey. And that's our semester. I love you guys.